Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm airing an interview I did with Broadway theater producer Ken Waisman. Ken was recently in Sarasota, Florida, where he, the cast and creative team of the brand new musical Josephine, was workshopping and also premiering at the Oslo Repertory Theater Company in preparation for a move to Broadway. Ken's story is surprising, but I'll let him tell it to you. Hang on, here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down you dive, where the child's gone to survive.
Person you really are. I know that it may seem absurd to ask, are you the person you really are? But as a therapist, I see very often people who, it seems to me, are living lives that are just a version of who they are. It's true what they present to the world and what they think about themselves, but it's not the whole truth. So very often, people are discouraged early in life from expressing what they would naturally express. So often, even with the best of intentions, parents, religious organizations, schools, peers, extended family, give children the idea that something about them is not right. Something they want to do will not serve them. Something that they do naturally is unattractive or not desirable. Well, as children, we really cannot afford to be someone our parents, our religious organizations, our teachers, our peers don't like, don't want, disapprove of. We really can't afford it. And so, what most people do is they find ways to pretend that this thing that they are, this thing that this thing that they want to express, they don't really have it. It isn't really there. they're really not it. Usually this is done by pretending at first, but quite often they get good enough at it that by the time they've grown up, they've forgotten who they really are. The good news is that you can't lose who you really are. You can't lose that thing that is natural to you to express, but you can bury it so deep that even you have forgotten it. The Lynn Show is about saying that even if this had happened to you, it may not be too late to recover what you had to lose or deny. In my show, I interview people who make their living or their life with an art, because when you listen to them, you can hear what it sounds like to be who you really are. And the man whose interview I am airing today, Ken Waisman, was so very fortunate. When he was just 6 years old, Ken was taken by his parents to see three Broadway musicals. The impact on him was instant and dramatic. And little Ken asked his father, who was the boss of this amazing thing? And his father said, the producer. What Ken did with that information is remarkable, extraordinary, amazing. So I'm going to let Ken explain it, and so you can be amazed as I was. Here now is Ken Waisman. So I'm here with Ken Waisman, who is here producing the premiere production of Josephine for the Oslo Repertory Theater Company. Is this correct?
Yes.
I interview people who make their living or their life with an art.
Terrific.
Yes. Yes.
Great.
You make your life and your living with the art of theater? Would that be accurate?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah? Okay. So I only ask one question, and it is, do you remember the very first minute in your life, the first event or occasion that theater, stories, acting, any of that called you, became attracted to you?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, good. Tell me.
Yes, the whole thing started because my parents, when I was like 6.5 years old, took me on a trip to New York, and we saw three Broadway shows in 3 nights. First night, we saw Finian's Rainbow with Ella Logan, the original production. The next night, we saw Born Yesterday with Judy Holliday.
Oh, my God.
And the third night, we saw Oklahoma. But from the first night when we saw Finian's Rainbow, and I remember where I was sitting in the theater, I remember Ella Logan at the footlights in front of the tree singing How Are Things in Glamora. And I was amazed. I couldn't believe that these were grown-up people doing this on stage, and it was their job. And they went to work like everybody else, my dad, everybody else. That's what they did.
Oh, my God. And you were aware of that even then.
See, I was fascinated with it. But I was also, my dad was in business, so at 6 years old, I was obsessed with the word boss. So when the show was over, we're coming up the aisle, and I said to my dad, who's the boss of this? And he said, the producer.
Oh, you're kidding.
And that was in August. September, I go back to school. And the reason I remember this is because the teacher called my parents, and they, you know, they talked about it. But she had a thing of going around the room the first day of school, asking her students what they wanted to be when they grew up. So she was getting all the usual answers, you know, policeman, fireman,
right,
whatever.
Right.
And she gets to me and I say, Broadway producer. So she calls my mother and she says, you know, I've been teaching for 20 years. And she said, I've heard everything, but I've never heard this. And my mother said, well, we just brought him back from New York. We took him to see some shows. He'll get over it.
Yeah, right.
But I didn't. By the time I was 11, I had talked my dad into helping me build a whole theater in our basement.
You're kidding.
And we had seating for 75.
What?
Yep. We had traverse curtains and, you know, a stage. In those days, in the years after the war, everybody was buying freezers, refrigerators, you know, things like that. So they would come in these wooden crisscross frames, and people would throw them out. So I, on the way home from school, would start collecting these wooden frames. I'd drag them home, and one of the neighbors showed me, if you cover it with brown paper, and then you take a spray, like when you're on an ironing board, is the water spray,
right?
And you spray it on the brown paper, it'll tighten and look like canvas.
Oh my.
And then you can paint on it. So that's what I did.
You painted sets?
I painted the scenery, yes. And my dad, we had...
What did you paint? Like trees and...
Well, trees
or... Or whatever was appropriate.
So like when we did Calamity Jane, you know, I had to paint the side of the cabin, and then we had other scenes.
You're 11?
Well, by the time we had Calamity Jane, I was like 13, but or 14. But we did Showboat. Oh, I did my version of Snow White. I would go to the movies, and I would see something that I fell in love with, like Showboat. And then I'd come home and write a stage adaptation of it. And I would use the kids in the neighborhood to be in it. And my dad would get me the cast albums, or the screen album.
Right.
And I would, with those old tape recorders, you know, I had the one-inch.
Yeah.
The ones.
Yeah. Reel-to-reels?
The reel-to-reels.
Right. So
I would sit there and I would, record it, splice in scenery, music for the scene changes.
You'd splice in music for the scene changes?
Yeah, I was splicing the tape.
Well, no, I understand about splicing, but where were you getting the music for
the music, my dad brought me the...
You would just record the entire thing?
I would record it. Yeah, use it the way I wanted.
Right.
And when it came time for a musical number, the kids would lip-sync.
Yeah,
the whole orchestra.
Oh, my God.
With speakers in the back of the stage. and Calamity Jane, the 12-year-old girl that was playing Calamity Jane would open her mouth and Doris Day would come out, And one of the kids in the neighborhood's aunt built costumes for summer stock and other places in Baltimore, Washington area. So she had a barn that was just loaded with every costume she ever made.
Oh my God.
And whatever show we were doing, we'd take the whole cast out, and she would fit everybody. We had, the costumes looked like they came out of the movie of Calamity
Jane. Oh, my God.
And we had Snow White's costumes, and we had... it was wonderful. And
did you sell tickets?
Yes. Yes. I had my mother call around to see which charity in Maryland would let us present the check, because we wanted to give all the proceeds
to
the charity.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Let us present the check for the proceeds on television. And only one agreed to do it, and that was the Maryland Cancer Fund. So every year, for the 4 years that I did this, from 11 to 14, we gave the money to the Maryland Cancer Fund, and they would put us on television. We'd present the check, and so forth. And
so you're not only a producer at 11 and 12, you're a promoter.
Well, but a producer.
Yeah,
what I didn't know, I was doing all the things that the traditional Broadway producer. I didn't know.
No, you didn't know.
No.
You
were my mother said, he was just putting on shows. Well, that meant,
right.
Publicity. It meant everything.
Yes. It meant sales, and it meant...
Yes.
Right.
Right. So we charged 50 cents for children and a dollar for adults. Because, and we did five performances in the afternoon, one for a week, and five at night. And at night, I wanted the adults to come. So I said, kids can't come at night unless they're accompanied by an adult.
Very nice.
So we got the adults to come.
Right.
And there was a Coca-Cola distributing company, not far, it was a good walk, but not far from where we were. So I went over there, and at 11 years old, because that was the first year they did it, and I made a deal with them that they would come out, and they would have the big coolers with Coca-Cola, and supply the Coca-Cola, and we would sell it for 10 cents. 5 cents would go to our charity, and 5 cents would go to them.
Oh, my God.
And then I went to, there was a cleaners plant, not far also. I don't mean a cleaners like you go in today, but this, the whole plant, they did everything
right
there.
Right.
And they had a woman who printed the little tickets and labels that were going to be on the cleaning things.
Yeah.
So she printed tickets for me.
Oh, my goodness.
So that's where we got our printed tickets.
So how did you sell the tickets?
Oh, the way we sold the tickets was we would rehearse in the morning. And then I would take one of the cast...
Oh, wait. Was this in the summer?
Yeah, in the summer.
Right. So then no school.
Right. And we would rehearse in the morning. And then in the afternoon, I would take one of the cast members. And we would canvas 10 square miles of where we were, knocking on doors. And I can still remember the speech. We're from the Pennhurst Players. And last year, we did Cinderella, and we raised $300 for the Cancer Fund. And this year, we're doing Showboat. And again, the money will go to the Maryland Cancer Fund. And tickets are 50 cents for children and a dollar for adults. And children can't come at night unless they're accompanied by an adult. And if you can't come at all, then we'd appreciate a donation.
Oh, my God.
And we'd come home, with all this money.
Right.
I took a jewel box with me. And we would come home with all this money. Also, during the winter, my dad, when he got his shirts clean, they all came back folded around a white cardboard.
Yeah, I remember.
And I collected all those cardboards, and then I'd sit there, making posters so that when the summer came, I was able to go around and for like 10 square blocks or 20 square blocks around their house, every tree had a poster. One of the neighbors said, you can always tell when Ken's show is going to happen because every tree in the area is covered with a poster. The Coca-Cola company pulls up. National Chair Rental pulls up with the 75 seats that we had in the in the theater. And my dad had built a dressing room for the guys and a dressing room for the girls. I don't know how my parents allowed this because I had everything plugged in to a board with extensions. And, I mean, the fact that I didn't set the house on fire is... I took an old slide projector and I made it into a spotlight. And then I took lollipop wrappers and I pasted them on cardboard frames to have gels.
You know, like yes, I understand.
And...
Wait. Some of this is very sophisticated. How did you know that there were lights, that there were gels, that there were...
Well, that part I knew because I had gone to Johns Hopkins University, had a wonderful theater program in those days for children. I started there, I guess maybe 9.
And you said to your parents, look, I'm not going to get over this. I need to do this.
Well, after that trip to New York, there was no question.
For you?
For what my interest was.
Right.
But my parents knew it too.
Right, well.
And I was very shy as a kid.
Really?
Yeah. So they supported this because, one, they're supportive people. And two, they thought it would help me.
Yeah, I understand.
Get over the shyness and stuff. I had no idea that I was doing, including firing people and whatever, a lot of the things that a Broadway producer has to do. My mother did not want everybody hanging around the house the entire summer. So she said, you can come in, you know, 10 days before you actually start performing. You can come into the theater downstairs. And I, of course, thought this was horrible and my mean mother, you know, and I'm throwing a tantrum. But around the corner, I found a two-car garage.
Oh, tell me, you found a rehearsal space.
That this neighbor did not use for cars. It was electrified. She had planned to use it as a storage or extra room or whatever, but it was just sitting there. So for a program credit, we rehearsed it. I didn't know at the time that you do not rehearse the Broadway show
in
the theater.
That is correct. And your mother was right.
And then a couple of weeks before you come
into the theater. That's right.
So my mother actually...
She set you up.
Yes.
That's right. That's right.
The other amazing thing was that in the summer when we were doing these shows, the kids became the adults and the parents became the children. When I did Calamity Jane, there was an actress that I cast to do one scene. So the mother of the girl that I cast to play it announces that she's not going to let her daughter be in it because the part, too small part. So I'm telling this to the girl's mother who's playing Calamity Jane. She said, that's ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. All the kids in the block are in the show. So she calls her.
She calls the mother.
Yeah, she says, Serena, why are you doing this? She'll be left out. All the kids in the block are in the show. So she's listening. She turns to me and she says, will you promise not to cut the song? Another day for rehearsals is when we were doing Showboat. It's a Saturday, and this one girl doesn't show up for rehearsal. So I called her. I said, Beverly, where are you? Mm-hmm. You know, you're late for rehearsal. She says, oh, not today.
Uh-oh.
She says, I'm going shopping with my mother today. I said, well, Beverly, not any day. You're fired. And I replaced her just like that.
Wow.
And her mother went berserk.
Yeah, right.
Her mother called my mother and said, he can't do that. You know, all the kids on the block are in it. He can't do that. You can't let him do that. And my mother said, it's not my show. The next day, I'm walking up the street, and this mother comes out of her house, and she yells across the street at me. She says, you little Hitler.
Oh, dear.
She said, I'm going to report you to the police because you're charging money. When I was a little girl, we did shows too, and we charged clothespins. I said, I don't think the Cancer Fund wants clothespins. you know, time I'm 12, 13, 14, and we're doing these shows in the summer, my father started to worry about it. He started to get a little nervous because he realized this was not
a passing thing.
Not going to be a passing thing.
Right.
And he had always, you know, had hoped that I would become, not a doctor, he wasn't that kind of Jewish father, but a lawyer. So he didn't expect me to go into the business, but a lawyer.
Right.
And so he started to get, you know, here he had been so supportive and cooperative, helped me build the whole thing.
Yeah.
Now he was saying, you're getting a little too old to do this kind of thing, and you know, this is not, don't want you to make this a career. So my mother said to him, she said, you know he's not going to change. You know that this is in his blood.
Wow.
So if you want to have a son, you're going to have to go along with it.
God bless her.
And he did. You know, he was very supportive after that.
Good for them.
When I got to college, I majored in radio, television, and theater department. I was majoring in that with a minor in journalism. I went first to the University of Maryland, and then I transferred to NYU, and I was in the School of the Arts. But while I was at the University of Maryland, I put together a variety show, and then I took a tape of some of the numbers and pictures and everything else, and I sent it to the Army Professional Entertainment Bureau in Washington. And they sent us out to the for a whole summer, performing at Army bases and military bases, Air Force base, all through the Caribbean. It was very exciting. While I'm at NYU, Sergeant Shriver comes, and he's talking in general about the Peace Corps. But then he comes to the radio and television and theater department and talks about a special television project that they're doing in Bogota, Colombia, televising cultural and educational television programs to children throughout the whole country. Philips Company had donated television sets so that every church rec center or the schools around, they all had televisions.
Wow.
The kids would go home and talk about watching something on televisions. They, in many of these little towns, they had no electricity in their houses. Mm-hmm. They had nothing.
Right.
And the parents didn't know what they were talking about.
Right.
But they were watching these television shows. And it appealed to me. I got very interested in that. One, because it appealed to my sense of adventure, mm-hmm. being in a foreign country, learning to work in a foreign language. We'd have to do everything in Spanish. Secondly, it was the Vietnam time, mm-hmm. and my draft board in Baltimore was deferring anybody who was in the Peace Corps. So that was an extra added bonus. But I thought also to come right out of NYU and to be able to be producing and directing, you know, a television show in a foreign language at a network in Colombia.
Wow.
You know,
right.
And it was a thrilling, you know, thrilling experience. Extremely popular. We got fan mail all the time. And I wanted to, the Peace Corps had Stanford University come down to see what the impact of these television mm-hmm. shows were.
Right.
Sort of like the Nielsen ratings.
Yeah.
And the minute I knew that, I went to the Peace Corps administration and I went to the network and I said, you've got to send us out once a month to do live performances of this show. And we went all over the country.
Wow.
You know, because I wanted to make sure that we increased the popularity.
Yeah.
Again, like the cardboard shirts.
That's right. Well, it's just another aspect of this thing. You do everything. Okay, so then theoretically this ends and you come back.
I come back.
And?
And the first opportunity I got was a classmate from NYU was now producing a show on Channel 13 called, and it was about people from famous people from New Jersey. And so they needed a host, you know, for that one little season there when I came back. While I was doing that, I wanted to get a job on Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
So I was writing to different producers, and I saw that George Abbott, who I had read about and I knew all
yeah,
about,
well.
You know, was doing a new show. So I wrote a letter, and I didn't hear anything back. So then I took a pinking shears, and I cut my resume completely in half. And I attached a note to it, to Mr. Abbott, saying, if you want to see the other half of me, I'm available at your convenience. And I got called in, and I got the job.
Oh, my God.
And so I worked with Mr. Abbott on three shows, The Education of Hyman Kaplan, mm-hmm. with Tom Bosley,
oh.
and Hal Linden, and Fig Leaves Are Falling, with David Cassidy, Dorothy Loudon, mm-hmm. and then he was called in by David Merrick to help fix How Now, Dow Jones. So I got to see, you know, that experience
wow.
too. None of those three shows turned out to be
big hits, right?
So I learned more watching what went on, and watching them not fix or try to fix or whatever it was. Watching Abbott even go back on a few principles of his, because when you're stuck right there and the audience is not reacting, and you tell Dorothy Loudon you're going to give her this song, which really belonged to another character, but hoping that she would make it, but of course it didn't.
Right.
You know, I'm watching all of this. You know, I'm there for all of it. And that was a real education. So then, after that, the Fig Leaves Are Falling that I worked with George Abbott on was produced by Friar Carr and Harris, who were also the producers of MAME. So I was working for them. And they did another show with Shirley Jones called Maggie Flynn, so I worked on that. And I was working on MAME, which was running, but they were doing a new production of Maine for Las Vegas, and Susan Haywood was going to star. And that's where I learned that just because you were a brilliant film actress, she was, doesn't mean you can act on stage. You know, and for the power that she had on screen, when we opened in Caesar's Palace,
right,
and she had to make her entrance at the first time in front of an audience, from the top of the stairs, she was like 4 inches high.
Oh, dear.
And she never got any taller throughout the entire performance. So I learned a very valuable lesson. When Maine closed on Broadway, shortly thereafter, I decided to try my hand at producing.
And how old were you?
And by then I was 27. Maxine Fox had been Barbara Streisand's assistant on Funny Girl. We'd been working as a casting agent. And so we started, we were going to partner. We took this ad in Variety, full page, saying these are our credits, you know. And we were really looking for scripts and projects,
right,
you know. We put all the logos of the different shows we worked on. Well, we got a lot of crazy crank calls.
Right.
But we got a call from a literary agent who said she wanted me to come to see a one-act play that was being done in St. Clement's Church, which is where they do, like, showcase things.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be done for 2 weekends. To see her client who was directing it, and her other client who wrote it.
Mm-hmm.
So I went, and the amazing thing about it was a two-character play. One character was a quadriplegic, so he never moved. The other character was the nurse, and she, of course, was all over. The director, Tom Moore, had gotten such movement out of all of this, and such sight gags, and brought out such humor in something that was very morbid.
Right.
You know, as a play. And I had to keep pinching myself to believe that these were really actors because I was...
You believed them, absolutely.
Oh, absolutely,
right.
So I said to the agent, I said, I don't think the play could be expanded to a full length, and I don't think it's a teaser type play for like a, you know, I don't think audiences, but who directed this? Who is he? So she said, his name is Tom Moore, and he is out as associate director of the Mark Taper Forum.
Oh.
He's in L.A. And I was going out there, and I said, I'm going to be out there. She said, oh, you are? Well, then I'd like you to go see a play that another client of mine wrote, Fortune in Men's Eyes, and Salminio. Salminio has done an adaptation, and he's doing a showcase of it out there. So I went out. Two things happened that were going to have a major effect on my career. One was a four-hour lunch with Tom Moore, and I knew that someday we were going to work together. I didn't know when. And the other was going to see this play.
No kidding.
You know, and I thought, oh, wow, this could be exciting. This, you know. So that became my first show.
And so you produced
Men's
it?
Eyes.
Oh, my God.
Sound Minio. And it was a hit. I mean, it wasn't a big hit, but we
back. It was a hit.
We paid back.
Right, yeah.
And then I did another play called, my second play was called Anne Miss Reardon Drinks a Little.
Mm-hmm.
Which I co-produced with a couple of other producers. And it had Julie Harris and Estelle Parsons.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a hit. You know, and now...
Two for two.
Yeah, now, my roommate from the University of Maryland, no less, who had become a dentist, was taking an orthodontry course in Chicago. And I get this call, and he says, Ken, he said, do you remember all the kids that hung out in the back of our high school in Baltimore? I said, the Drape and Drapettes,
mm-hmm.
because that's what we call the ducktail set. He said, well, there's a play with some music that sounds like it came out of the 50s, playing in Old Town in the basement of a trolley barn. He said, and Susan, his wife, he said, Susan and I went to see it, and I think you ought to take a look at it. So I checked around New York, and finally one person had heard of it. They said, oh, it's a little community theater, you know, and it's sort of amateurish. But my friend, who in college was known as never having a positive thing to say about anything, called me back and said, I think you should come see this.
Mm-hmm.
So I flew out to Chicago. Phil and Susie picked me up at the airport. We went to this theater where there weren't even seats. They gave you newspapers.
Down
the floor. And the scenery was familiar to me because it was brown painted, brown paper painted.
Yuck.
The cast had done it themselves.
Oh, my God.
And it was... they had about seven, eight songs, maybe. And some of them, we used, some of them we didn't. The story went on and on and on. You could go out, have dinner, come back, and you would miss nothing. But it was about the 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw my yearbook coming to life on stage when these kids came out.
Right.
And I thought the two guys that wrote it had real talent.
Mm-hmm.
And I believed that as a Broadway musical, I could be successful.
Yes.
So I said to them afterwards, I said, if you guys want to move to New York, I said, I'll work with you. But I believe that you can write a full score. I said, and, you know, you can write
chop
a book.
Chop this up a little.
And write the book. Well, there were no central characters. Of course, we're talking
well,
about...
Well, it was a review, kind of, right?
No, it was a play.
Really?
Yeah, a play that went on and on and on. we're talking about Greece.
Yeah, right.
Of course.
right.
No, the story went on and on and on. Danny and Sandy were sort of there as part of the ensemble, but nobody really was a central. You know,
right.
So you got to pull out, you know, a central character. I said, it seems like Danny and Sandy should be that. And a boy meets girl, boy loses girl format. Mm-hmm. Because I had worked for George Abbott.
Yes, right.
And he invented it.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, I said, so if you come to New York, I said, I really believe that this could work, you know, as a musical. So they did. Mm-hmm. And we started, the script the way it was, I couldn't let any director, anybody see it. So we had to sort of at least get a draft going. And I knew immediately, though, that Patricia Birch should choreograph this. Because the one thing that I wanted to do was, I didn't want it to be Dames at Sea. I didn't want it to be 42nd Street.
Yeah, right.
I wanted you to think that these kids came alive from your book.
I was just going to say that it really was the
50s,
right?
And that they really went out in the jalopy and got hamburgers afterwards.
Yeah, right.
And so I thought Patricia Birch, who had just done The Me Nobody Knows, mm-hmm. in which she was making actors look like they were trained dancers, but so real because it was kids in a inner city thing. Mm-hmm. And I remembered Welcome to Andromeda, which Tom Moore had directed. Mm-hmm. And I being, you know, they were so real to me.
Right.
So I called Tom. I had him come engineer. He was in California, but I had him fly in to meet the authors. And we're sitting in Joe Allen's restaurant.
Oh, yeah.
And Jim Jacobs, the co-author of Grease, was a very outgoing guy. Warren Casey, was a withdrawn, you know. So Jim, because he's so outgoing, Tom in here having a whole conversation. So when it was finished, Warren Casey said, I don't like him. He never talked to me.
Oh, dear.
You know, meanwhile, on the way back to the airport, Tom said to me, you know, I read the script. I always hated those kind of kids.
Oh.
You know, I said, Tom, you will make them likable. You will you know, give them the vulnerability and that quality.
Right.
And make them real. You know, that's why I'm interested. I said, so when you get back on the plane, and you go out to back to California, read it again.
Right.
So he gets off the plane. He calls me. He runs to a phone booth. No cells in those days. He calls and he said, I hope I didn't talk myself out of the job. I said, no, you didn't, but you have to come back. And I said, this time you have to pay attention to Warren. This is what you got to do.
Yeah.
I said, you got to pay attention to Warren Casey.
Right.
You know, and we'll cement it.
Right.
And then I took him to meet Pat Birch. Mm-hmm. And Pat was very nervous. He's never, who is he? He's done some off-Broadway things, associate, you know.
Right.
I said, Pat,
trust me,
you're going to be a good team. Mm-hmm. So Tom arrives at her house. I sit the two of them on the sofa, you know. And within minutes, they're buddies, they're collaborators, you know. And to this day, they're still extremely close. And they've worked together several times.
My God. Well, and of course, this changed your life.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, of course.
Right.
But starting with Sal Mineo's project, you know,
yes,
which then
right,
launched
right,
me,
right.
And then of course Grease. So you know, part of producing, at least traditionally, you know, is matching up the talent.
Yes.
And putting people together.
Yes.
When David Merrick had the idea of making a musical out of Hello Dolly was based on a play.
Right.
And isn't this terrible?
No.
That's why I say, how soon do you need to know the name?
I know, I got it.
No, like the back of my thumb. But anyway, he had seen Milk and Honey, which was not a particularly good show, but he was very impressed with the young man who had written the score, Jerry Herman. You know, so he calls him in, you know, and says, write me a couple of samples for this story.
Right.
And then, of course, the rest is history.
Right.
But that's what producers used to do. I watched it change over the years.
Yes.
Because as the budgets got bigger and bigger, you know, the profit margins got bigger and bigger, too.
Mm-hmm.
An investor today on a hit makes so much more than he ever made back in the 60s or even in the early 70s. Mame, which was produced for $500,000 at the Winter Garden Theater, it took about 7 months to pay that back. And it ran for about 3 years, which was considered wow.
Right.
Mamma Mia in the same theater, you know, opened in 2002, I believe, at a cost of $10
million.
They paid back in 4.5 months.
They
ran forever,
yeah,
and
right.
the investors are still,
making money. Right.
So, but raising
$10 million
and still a
right.
tour.
Yeah, that's right.
So they started, you know, producers, they started giving producer billing to people that would make large investments.
Right.
And then down the line, some of these traditional producers that really did put together musicals. When I came into the business, a musical was considered a producer's medium.
Yes.
Because he put it together. It very often started with him, or somebody may have brought him something, but it started the process. And it's such a collaboration that he put together the collaborators.
Yes.
And then as George Abbott always said, which I now say, and then kept reminding everybody why he got them together in the first place. You know, but then over the years, some of those people started dying out or moving to California. And the people who had been getting the billing became the producers.
Yes.
And so that changed the tone.
Yes.
It's because of that change that happened. You know, it's easy to take, I'm not saying it's easy to make it work, but it looks easy on paper to take a movie and turn it into a musical.
Right.
But 9 times out of 10, the heart is lost somehow.
Yes.
It doesn't quite translate.
It doesn't translate,
you know?
Right.
And, of course, revivals are an easy thing for a checkbook producer or, you know, to do.
Right.
But original musicals, which take so long
yes.
to develop,
yes.
partially now because every creative person is global.
Yes.
You know, again, back in the earlier days.
Yeah, they were in New York.
They were in LA.
Right, everybody.
And it
right,
seemed
right,
like everybody
right.
was available.
Right.
You know, now a producer is developing a show, will spend more time planning when he could get everybody into the same yeah. sandbox.
Right. And actually, let's talk about Josephine
yes.
from that point of view, because I know this has been a long project for
yes.
you. Right. So talk about how,
sure.
because I know you had to wait for Deborah, didn't you?
Well, at one point we waited for Deborah.
Right.
But what happened was, I became fascinated with Josephine Baker mm-hmm. way back in the 70s when, a few years before she died, I saw her perform at the Palace Theater.
Oh my God.
And I was like, what a presence.
Right.
Not a great singer, not a great dancer, but what a
never
presence.
Mind, right.
Never mm-hmm. mind. And I started learning a little more about her. But then, about 15, 20 years later, I come across the first biography that was written about her by her manager, Stephen Pappage, Remembering Josephine. And in it, he says in her own words, he describes her affair with Crown Prince Gustav of Sweden, Prince and the Showgirl,
mm-hmm.
and all her work in the French Underground,
oh.
which absolutely fascinating, you know,
right.
I thought was amazing. A woman who transcended her race, she transcended her time, her gender.
Everything.
You know, and never fully appreciated in her own native country.
Right.
And so I became, you know, I started, to, after I read that book, I thought, at some point, I'm going to make a musical out of this. And I was involved in a couple other things, and then all of a sudden, it was about maybe almost 12 years, maybe, you know, I said, I got to do it. I'm going to do this. So I started looking to who would write it, and I'd known Evelyn Weston's work. I thought, I after talking to a couple of book writers, I realized, or I thought, I need a woman's attitude on this, because I wrote the story that I wanted to tell,
mm-hmm.
and a coming-of-age story, where she finally gets the self-esteem that she's been chasing in all the wrong directions.
Yes.
You know, fame, royalty, money, and the work in the French underground.
Is what does it
is
for
what
her.
Does it.
Yeah.
And so...
Oh, I love that.
You know, and so she's finally able to let go of this prince fantasy and see the real prince who's been there all along, her conductor, Joe Bullion.
Wow.
Of course, in real life, they got married after the war.
Wow.
You know, and adopted all those children. So, I wanted that story told, and I thought, you know, maybe a woman writer could help get that better. But I also wanted the whole flamboyancy of Josephine being on stage and that kind of a thing. And I was a great fan of Full Gallop, which Mark Hampton had co-wrote.
Mm-hmm.
And so I put them together. Another one of these Pat Bates times.
Yeah, I put them together.
Mm-hmm. And looking for the composer, I went up to the Colony because somebody had recommended seeing if I could get a CD of a musical that these young kids had written that was done in Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
They had it, actually. And when I gave it to the salesman who had been waiting on me since I worked for George Abbott, I mean, everybody knew him. He's mm-hmm. an institution with his dyed black hair. He looked like a hoofer from the Borscht Belt. And when he got the, saw my credit card, because he knows everybody in the business, he said, why are you listening to this? Are you doing a new musical? I said, yes, Josephine Baker, 1939 and 1945, Fully Appreciated. Oh, you want to hear this. And it was a CD of a review called Lunch, which was done in San Diego. So I said, sure. It had been like close to four years that I've been looking for a composer. 12 years? Yeah, almost 3 years. So I take it home, and after the third cut, I knew these guys could write our score.
Yeah.
I knew they had the feel.
Yeah,
for
it's
it.
John Bettis and Stephen Dorff.
John Bettis and Stephen Dorff. And a funny story that I didn't tell was I didn't recognize them as the major pop artists that they are.
Yes, right.
So I started trying to track them down. Mm-hmm. And I finally got an address, I thought, for Steve Dorff. Mm-hmm. So I send a FedEx.
Right.
Explain the whole thing. I get a call the next day, and I answer the phone. He said, this is Stephen Dorff. I said, Steve. He said, you wrote my father. I'm the son, meaning the movie actor.
Yeah, right.
He said, my dad is in Hawaii with his girls, because he had remarried and had two young girls. He said, with the girls, but he's coming back on Friday, and he wanted me to let you know, that he's going to give you a call. Okay. So that's what started that. But.
And Steve told me that after this, he was in New York, and he went to the Colony, and he said to this guy, you got me this gig, and he gave him $100.
And also said, I'm going to give you opening night seats on Broadway.
Oh, he didn't tell me that. Yeah. He didn't tell me that. Oh, that's great. That's great. Right. Okay. So you found Mark and Ellen, and you put them together, and you found Steve and
John.
And John.
But they were already partners.
They've been writing together forever, right. And then, did you always know it was going to be Joey?
No. I started out thinking who should direct.
Right.
And it's so interesting how many successful directors on Broadway have not really worked with new material.
Ah.
Or limitedly.
Right.
And I'm used, from the old school, I'm used to a director who can work with the writers, who sees where we...
Right, who's a collaborator.
Wherever our draft is.
Right.
He sees where it is, mm-hmm. what's wrong. He can work with the writers, mm-hmm. All the way through.
Right.
And I wasn't getting that. I don't want to mention the name, but one prominent director who read it said, the character of Joe, the conductor, is not very well developed, because we knew this. I said, that's one of the things that we need to achieve here.
Right.
I said, what are your thoughts? He said, well, I don't really get into that, but if you do another draft, and I'd like to read it again.
Yeah, when you get it done, oh, very nice.
So I thought, I get that.
Right.
Meanwhile, I had zeroed in on Joey to do the choreography,
mm-hmm.
because what he had done in Smokey Joe's Cafe,
mm-hmm.
There was sex to it,
yeah.
And humor, and the girl in the white fringe dress, I mean, what a dance, I never forgot that. And I had kept him in mind. But now, I said to Joey, I called him, I said, Joey, I want you to put on a director's hat. He had directed, but not anything new. He had directed some things for The Road and some other. I said, I want you to put on your director's hat. I want you to read the draft that we have, mm-hmm. and I want you to give me notes as a director. And so a couple of days later, we sit down, and he's telling me everything I want to hear.
Uh-huh.
there were solutions, or there were zeroing in on this, or, and in a way that I would, that I thought directors should do and can talk to playwrights about, or
right.
book writers about.
Right.
And so I said, you're going to direct on Broadway. You're going to direct your first musical on Broadway.
Wow. Oh, my God. All right. So so how?
Then, of course, we started working.
Mm-hmm.
And, the draft that we originally had, of course, was a pre-score draft.
Mm-hmm.
So now we're putting in the songs. They're writing the score. And we're reworking. And now we do a reading.
Mm-hmm.
We do five performances. And then...
Well, wait a minute. How did you find your star?
Well, we didn't find Deborah yet.
Oh.
Our first readings, first readings for a couple of years there
right.
that we did were with different actresses.
Uh-huh.
And not even necessarily thinking that they'll be the one.
Right.
But it was just to get it
on his feet. Right.
And so after each reading, we would go back to the drawing board.
Right.
I would invite certain people to come who I knew would be candid with me and who I respected their insight
right.
and intelligence when looking at something. And then I would take each one of them to lunch. I did this after every reading, and we must have done about 4 or 5 readings. And I took them to lunch, each one, and I would ask them questions or hear what they had to say. And what was amazing is how it all seemed to boil down. If I took 10 people to lunch, you know, you could eventually see that there were like a few things that they all were being bothered by. You know, or all loved, but being bothered by, you know, that we would work on. Right. It's like peeling an onion. So the next reading we would do, those things seemed to be, it opened the door to have us see other things that don't work.
Wow.
And of course I would take these people to lunch again.
Right. You know?
And then finally, we were going to do another reading, our final reading, because we wanted to do a workshop after that. So the final reading was when we started auditioning and Deborah walked in. Now here's the irony here, and she and I laugh about this. She walked into the audition. We didn't know she was coming in. Casting person surprised us, because we knew her, who she was. But so she walks in, and she hands the music to the piano player, and her audition song was Look to the Rainbow.
Wow, from Finian's Rainbow.
So I leaned over to Ellen, the book writer Weston, who was sitting next to me, and I said, she's going to give us a great audition. Ellen said, how do you know? I said, she just sang Look to the Rainbow, the show that I saw that started my career. Rainbow. And she did give us a really good audition.
It's another Bachere thing, right?
Yes,
right,
Bachere.
Right.
So, and so we decided to give her the role. Mm-hmm. And so we did this reading, and when you do readings, you have like a week rehearsal. When you do a workshop, you have a couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. Still, you know, it's amazing. So after that, several months after that, we reworked and reworked and reworked. And then we decided to do a workshop at New World Stages. We did 5 performances. And Deborah broke her toe.
Oi, oi.
But the trooper that she is, she went on as if it never happened. Every performance, did all the choreography.
Oh, my God.
I mean, talk about a trooper.
Oh, my God.
You know, and everybody fell in love with her.
Yeah.
Well, she has an innate vulnerability. And in the first act, Josephine is the diva. She becomes more likable when she goes through her transformation in the second act. Not that she's unlikable in the first act, but, you know, she's a diva. And Deborah was the perfect combination because she's just got this vulnerability that's always there.
Yeah. And she takes the stage. I mean, even in the press thing.
Oh, yes.
You could see. I mean, she owns it.
Yes, you know. So everybody loved her. Well, she was going to be going out on a tour of Jekyll and Hyde. So I get a call from Phil Smith, you know, the Shubert's, because he had come, and he said, what are you going to do? You hired somebody to do this wonderful workshop who was already booked to do this tour.
Right.
I said, we're debating that. We're trying to think, you know, if we can get a theater in the next year or so, do we find somebody else? He said, I don't think you're going to do better than her for your first Josephine person. So we decided we'd wait. So we waited for her. In the meantime, we started thinking about, you know, doing a world premiere somewhere. And 2 years ago, Norman Tulson and his wife, who I've been friends with for a long time, they're the producing partners of Bob Bartner.
Ah!
You know, and so they come in for the Tonys, and they take me to lunch. They've been watching Josephine along the way. Mm-hmm. They had heard all about this workshop with Deborah. They were hearing it from all their friends. Mel Nugent, this one, that one. So they said to me, you know what? Because I said, we're looking for an out-of-town. We're looking for...
Right.
And he talked to Michael Edwards.
Yeah.
She said, the Oslo is a wonder... And I had heard good things about the Oslo.
Yeah.
I didn't know Michael, though. She said, talk to Michael Edwards, you know, I'm going to tell him that you're going to talk to him and get him the script, you know, and that's what happened. He was going to Europe, so we were supposed to talk further when he came back. By the time he came back, of course, he was working on West Side.
Right.
So he had already wanted Joey. He comes into New York first. He and Joe go to lunch, and in the middle of the lunch, Joey says to him, so what's going on with Josephine? I know, you know, you're supposed to be talking to Ken about Josephine. Right. And Michael said, oh, that's right, you're doing Josephine. So he says to Joey, well, he said, will you promise me you'll do West Side Story? Then I promise I'll do Josephine.
Having given a life to this work, what would you say about what it's like?
It's very interesting because I've been doing this for so long.
Yeah.
And yet, working on this project and being here working with Michael and the Oslo people,
yeah,
I feel like, you know, this is a highlight. At the top of my game. both in energy and excitement and the joy of working with all these people.
After all the experiences you've had and all the success you've had, there's still more. There's still more to have, and you're getting it now.
Well, hopefully, knock on
wood. No,
we're very superstitious people. We have to knock on wood whenever.
Well, but you're getting the joy of the work.
Yes.
You know?
Yes, absolutely.
And then if you get the dream come true, that's
right.
Gravy, but you're
right.
Getting the joy of the work,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes.
Right.
And the process, you know, I remember reading one time a quote from Abraham Lincoln, and it was, "I will enjoy every step of the ladder toward where I'm going."
Yes.
And that stayed with me. You know, and I must say in my younger days, I didn't have that patience. In the younger days, I always wanted to fast forward to the opening.
Yeah.
But now, you know, I'm much more, I'm older, wiser, and I've developed a way of being in the present, you know.
It's
every minute, but in general.
Oh, it's lovely.
And so I'm there for the process.
Yes. And so you get to enjoy every step of the ladder, right?
And I let the process run its course. You know, I'm not sitting here right this minute trying to fend off cannonballs that might be fired in the future, but aren't, haven't been, and maybe won't. I deal with what's here right now. We, our musical director, Don, who did West Side Story,
right.
Don Chen. You know, there was a tragedy. His wife died, so we had to replace him with Sino. You know, the young guy, the one that Michael's always kidding about. And so the day that happened, Michael calls me and tells me that this is going on. And so my first thought was, Michael, who do you know that we can get right away?
Would
really be good. Everything was in the present moment. Somebody said to me, "Did that throw you at the dinner that they had last Saturday night?" Did that throw you?
Right.
Did that like keep you from functioning? I said, "No, it glued me to the present, to the moment."
Yes.
We solved it right away.
Yes, yes.
You know, it was unfortunate.
It's because you're in the present.
Yes.
That you can.
No throwing fits. You know, no throwing up.
No.
It was Michael.
Yeah.
Who else can we get right now?
And
so we have to get them in 24 hours. And he recommended Sino, and he said, "We've used him before, he's this, he's that." Set up a thing for Joey and him, you know, and Joey said, "Oh, yeah." And then the orchestrator said, "Oh, yeah, he'd be great." So just like that, we solved it. You have to.
Well, it's this idea of staying with the moment and enjoying each of the steps on the ladder. I think that's a really great place to stop. Thank you so much, Ken.
Thank you.
So, as I said at the beginning of the show, The Lynn Show is about being the person you really are. Too many of us have who we really are challenged in our early life. And we decide that it's not worth risking the disapproval, the criticism, sometimes even worse than that. So we find ways to dissemble. In my book, I say we create a cover story. Just like a spy creates a cover story, that is, they know that if they are exposed as who they really are, they'll be in danger. And this is very much how it is for too many people. They believe that if the real them is exposed, it will be dangerous, or at the very least unpleasant. And so they create a cover story. Unlike a spy, however, I believe that when we create a cover story, we put those aspects of ourselves which we are hiding under cover. So they don't go away. When we create a cover story, we quite often forget who we really are, and we place those potentially difficult aspects of ourselves under cover. I air interviews with people who make their living or their life with an art, because when you listen to them, you can hear who they really are. And it is my hope that as you were listening to Ken, who never lost the certainty of who he is, what he needs to do in his life, you're asking yourself, is this how I feel about my life? Or have you still got aspects of yourself hidden under cover? And are you still presenting a cover story to the world and maybe even to yourself? Well, if the answer is yes, I might be in denial for some important things about myself. I have always felt that maybe there were things about me that I haven't explored, or maybe even I know those things. I know those things that when I see other people doing them, I think, gee, I'd like to do that. I have not somehow been able to find that in myself. Well, it is my belief that it may not be too late.
I always like to say that just because I say it's there and you can have it back doesn't mean that if you say, oh, okay, good, I'll take it back now. When we go to recover something that we have been in denial for, all the reasons that we were in denial for it come back. And so that's what makes it so difficult to do. And of course, that is the job of psychotherapy. So if you think this may have happened to you, and if you want to see if maybe you can recover something you might have lost, and you want to talk to me about that, you can find me at my website. That's thelynnshow.com, thelynnshow. Don't leave the E out of Lynn. As always, I hope that you got something you can use from this show. Something that inspired you, something that amused you, something, some information you didn't have that you now have. Something that will bring you back, because I will be back next week, same time, same station. And as always, I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go. My shot, my time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes, every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. On singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have got